Welcome to the Month End, the CPG Community Chat. The Month End will provide emerging CPG brands real-life knowledge into the accounting, finance, and operational worlds. Our guests will be key stakeholders from those same brands, as well as other key contributors to the industry, all of which have vast experiences and insights that will be shared with the audience. Welcome to episode 12 of the Month End Podcast. Here today is Aaron Gotti of Brahmi. How are you doing today, Aaron?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing well. Looking forward to the chat. Accountfully's had a relationship with Brahmi and Aaron for probably the last 4 or 5 years. And it's a very kind of unique product that I had never heard of before working together. Give a little background of kind of Brahmi, you know, what you sell, products you sell, things like that, and just kind of give the audience a little high level of Brahmi.
Yeah, happily. At a high level, we're a plant-based whole foods packaged goods company. We're striving to make the slow food Mediterranean diet easy for the modern consumer. And we sell ready-to-eat lupini beans and lupini bean dips in various flavors. Lupini beans are incredibly unique in the plant world. They're a leader in the key satiating macronutrients of protein and fiber while having virtually no net carbs. So in terms of what do I snack on that'll satisfy my hunger without ruining my diet, I would argue there's really nothing else that compares on a macronutrient basis. And the fun thing about our products is you can integrate them into your life in many ways. We like to position ourselves as your daily plant protein source. You can use them as a snack, as a salad topper, or in stir fries instead of tofu. It's soy free. And same with the dips. You can dip them, you can spread them, you can use it as a pasta sauce, you can mix it in as a salad dressing. It's very versatile.
So the million-dollar questions. Why lupini? How did, like, clearly you just gave the background and the benefits of it, but how did you become familiar with it?
So the funny thing is I discovered them on my own in Italy. I'm from New York, but my dad is from Rome, and I used to be let free in the small towns of Italy as a kid, and I somehow discovered them on my own. And it was so early on in my life that I don't even remember the exact moment. I just remember being passionate about them my whole life. I didn't actually even know what they were at the time. I was just totally hooked on them. I would crush a whole bag. To me, they were just as addicting as any salty snack like potato chips. And then it wasn't until 6 years ago when I introduced them to my now wife, who was on a plant-based diet, and she made the comment, oh my God, this, it's like an Italian edamame. How do I not know about this? I'm always looking for plant protein clean snacks. And that's when we started researching it, and we discovered it has an ancient history dating back to the ancient Egyptians. And the Romans used them as portable protein for their soldiers, and we discovered this incredible macronutrient profile. They're literally off the charts. If you plot protein density and fiber density on X and Y axes, lupini is off to the right in an area of its own.
I'm looking for a new snack here, healthy snack. I might just order some here after this this podcast. So I'm sure with that information, there's a ton of like consumer education of just what is lupini beans and what is it? Like, how do you guys tackle that?
Yeah, well, so I had this passion for food and doing something that was good for people's diets and that would help their lives. And, you know, I grew up with this focus on simple quality ingredients when I spent time with my family in Italy, and then came back home and was horrified to see what was in the nutrition labels of the stuff that I ate back home. And I decided that it was something that like incredibly unique to the market, but addressed an everyday problem that millions of Americans faced every day, which was, you know, what I'm ravenous at 3 p.m. What do I snack on that's not going to ruin my diet? And so I had a really good hook and sort of market opportunity, but definitely a lot of education there. And I think, you know, now we started in retail and now we're omnichannel and realizing that online is a great way to educate consumers these days. And, you know, retail is a little more challenging. You really only have the pack and it's not, you know, the easiest story to tell. Consumers are not used to freshly pickled snacks. So, I mean, the packaging communication is key. We did a packaging, rebrand, a few years ago to help with that. You know, we had a lot of learnings from the early days that we incorporated into the packaging. And then now we're just really focused on telling the story, online, both paid and organic, social. And now we're digging into influencers and getting them to help us tell the story.
Awesome. Well, that leads us right into the next kind of the first big topic I want to chat about is sales channels. So you just mentioned that you started really heavily in retail from a you know, percentage of sales focus years ago, but now you're kind of more omni-channel, you know, hitting Shopify, hitting Amazon, through distribution still and other things. So kind of how I guess if we go back to, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago when you started, why did you select distribution or retail, and what has made the impact, you know, to change and to move into more omni-channel standpoint?
Well, I'd like to say that I had a very well thought out channel strategy, but the reality is that after our first production run, we went to Expo West, literally like a month or two after starting production. We didn't have distribution. We were starting to sell online, but attended Expo West. That was certainly at the time the focus for consumer natural food brands. And the buyers, you know, natural buyers really saw the benefit and the uniqueness and the opportunity very quickly. And so we sort of were just launched into retail right out of the gate, and had to kind of scramble to manage all the aspects of that. And that really, you know, took up all of our bandwidth and capital. And it wasn't until we sort of got our feet under the ground there that we were able to then turn our attention to other channels that were good for our storytelling.
Gotcha. So now that you're in kind of all these channels, you know, what do you, like, how do you assess or, you know, report on each channel from a profitability standpoint or success standpoint? So how do you look at a direct consumer via Shopify website as successful, or Amazon, or distribution? And how do you look at that now as the, you know, the founder of this company and making decisions on which channel to go into?
Yeah, I mean, because it's a, you know, it's a very natural forward product, we've become a lot more selective in how we continue to build our retail strategy, and using our learnings to execute thoughtfully on a growth plan there. We view retail as really, as, you know, still the big opportunity to grow a brand, but it needs to be managed carefully. Unless you have something that's just obvious to every consumer, you know, we're still in the early adopter phase. And so we just have to be very selective in how we build that out. But we see this as the answer to a big problem that every American, you could argue, has every day. And so we still see retail as the big opportunity. It just has to be a more strategic build. Online, it's a lot easier to connect with those natural forward consumers across the board in one or two places.
Is there a favorite from your perspective of like of where you like selling versus maybe, you know, like you said, retail is the one that you still see as the huge opportunity there long-term, but, you know, do you prefer other ones just from a, you know, maybe a profitability standpoint or just maybe more of an efficiency standpoint or anything like that?
I mean, I think, you know, every channel has its challenges and opportunities, and it is very, you know, each brand is going to have their own relationship with different channels and their own fits for different channels. So I wouldn't want this to be taken as a kind of blanket statement. Amazon has definitely been a big one for us. It was out of the gate. It was hard to get the sort of flywheel going. So it was not terribly fruitful at the beginning. And so I think that's true of so many of every channel, is that there's, you know, you need a certain amount of time and capital to kind of get it going. But once Amazon started going, it's been a really great driver of growth for us. We also love the natural channel, especially with consumers who are ready to adopt new items, who are really thoughtful about what they put in their body. And then, you know, now, you know, we went from retail focus to retail and Amazon focus to now retail, Amazon, and Shopify focused. And Shopify is hard, especially now with the iOS change. But what's really exciting there is the ability to have a deeper relationship with the consumer, especially for a product like ours, to be able to talk to them and send them recipes and add value with recipes and sort of content around the Mediterranean diet and how our products can help. And because of our positioning of this being your source of daily plant protein, we're really excited about the potential of growing our subscription business and having that close relationship.
Yeah, I think that all makes sense. And the amount of work you have to put into each, or the direct conversations or direct support you have with customers, really varies by channel, which is always interesting. Moving on to kind of supply chain inventory. So clearly this bean comes from Italy. So you're basically buying, what is your supply chain like, you know, buying from Italy, shipping over, just kind of explain that. And has your supply chain always looked the same in terms of, you know, what you're buying or who you're working with, or have you tweaked that? Because clearly, you know, working with some international vendors or suppliers isn't always the norm or familiarity with a lot of our, you know, audience listeners here.
Yeah, well, I really picked a doozy of an item to launch here because, you know, a lot of education, as we talked about, that's improving every day, gets better and easier. And the supply side was a massive challenge because, I didn't realize coming into this industry for the first time, we were the first company that I know of doing a pickled veggie in a shelf-stable, ready-to-eat pouch. I mean, the closest thing were the olives in pouches. They had olive oil and less moisture, and it's a different product. But that would be the closest comparison. But it turns out there are no manufacturers in the U.S. that really were set up to do this. And I was trying to avoid having to import it, do it abroad, you know, just for obvious supply chain reasons. And we tried twice to kind of co-pack it, if you will. But really, they're just the uniqueness of the production process. And we also were doing, not only was it something new to the market, but we prepare ours in a way that traditional lupini products that you might find in jars in some Mediterranean focused stores And so, you know, even when we, so we weren't able to scale it in the US, nobody was set up for it. And then in the meantime, Italy's leading producer of lupini invested in the pouching machines that were kind of the missing link there. And, you know, even there, our process was different from theirs. And there was a lot of work to be done there as well. But having a company that was generally set up for this type of production was a huge win. And so, you know, the cost of dealing with exchange rates and long lead times was more than worth it. The quality of the product is really incredible. It's not an easy product to get right. A lot of those jarred lupinis have artificial preservatives. They're not ready to eat. The skins are really thick and you don't really want to eat them. You really want to pop them out, and then you lose the fiber of the skins. They're unflavored. They're usually over salty. And so we now have Italian grown and Italian small batch produced lupini beans of incredible quality that is really hard to replicate. And so in our situation, we're really happy with our arrangement. Obviously, all else equal, importing and paying in a strong currency is not ideal.
Well, we're going to talk about that. So then I guess number one, how do you tackle, just from a pure landed cost standpoint, foreign exchange rates? Because clearly those can fluctuate. You know, how do you manage any fluctuation you know, from a currency standpoint? Let's touch base on that one first, and then I got a couple other follow-ups.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing. I mean, if you're a multinational corporation producing a commodity, you don't really need to, you can manage, you know, a year out or 2 years out and switch to another manufacturer with another currency if you have to. We're actually partners with this Italian company. They're a shareholder, and we have a strategic relationship, and they're really the only ones in the world who can do what we do. And so we have a long-term euro exposure that's virtually impossible to manage over a lifetime, but really the best you can do is manage, you know, 1 to 2 years out, depending on your capital position. And I would say, you know, the sort of standard approach is you set a target rate beyond which you're not comfortable. And then you either lock in spot when you can, or do forwards at rates below that as much as you can, as far as you can. Obviously, the farther out, the more you pay in the forward rates, at least when dealing with the euro dollar. And so right now, I've been buying a lot of spot now that it's gone below 1.2. And I'm looking to do forwards to kind of cover our projected cash flows over the next 2 years. And that's probably the best we can do. There are some derivative products that allow you to protect your exposure in kind of unique ways, where like maybe you give up some of the upside if rates come down a lot, but you protect your downside. It's something I'm still considering, but it's more complicated, and you know, the traditional way is really just to lock in forwards if and when you can.
Yeah. Well, Wall Street's got a job opening for you. Probably doesn't work out, Aaron.
Well, I came from the hedge fund world.
Gotcha. There you go. What just for the listeners, what like systems are you using to buy and selling rates, and like, you know, what platforms?
There are a few companies out there that are sort of non-bank foreign exchange service providers, and We work with one who they've been very flexible with us and given us a great line of credit. And I have access to a portal where I can buy spot directly there, and they'll hold my my euros, and I can pay my suppliers right out of their portal, or I can, you know, get on the phone with them whenever and talk about forwards. And they're really great about sort of talking me through what the market is seeing. They'll send me their forecasts, not only their forecasts, but the forecasts of like the top 10 currency traders according to Bloomberg. And so, you know, it's like another key strategic relationship. You know, manufacturing number one, warehousing logistics number two, and then somewhere is this relationship with these currency providers.
It's great, man. It's crazy how each you know, company we deal with or brand or, you know, whatever, all has specific challenges or specific items that they need to focus on. So, you know, moving on to like freight, duties and taxes. So clearly like lead times are impacted, you know, inventory quality, you know, it's a concern of being on a boat over X number of weeks or whatever coming over from Italy. You know, I guess the first question is like, is there a ton of fluctuation in duties, import taxes, freight? You know, like clearly there's a lot of regulations that can impact all that type of stuff. Plus, you know, some of the supply chain issues with the Suez Canal the last, what, two months, I'm sure it's kind of, you know, you're on the edge of your seat kind of making sure and understanding where that is. So like, how do you, you know, from just a pure maybe cost standpoint, like factor in or look at, you know, freight, duties and taxes, because you're just talking about foreign exchange and it's something that's completely out of your hands where you're looking to control it through these buying and selling, you know, futures. But then how do you handle that from a freight, you know, duties and taxes standpoint? And is there opportunities within there?
Well, that's another key area of strategic relationships. We have a freight broker based in Italy who, with a family business with tons of experience importing to the U.S. and great relationships with the shipping lines, really deep relationships with the shipping lines. And I mean, we really lean on them a lot. They've been amazing. They'll like fight for us and give us heads up, and you know, we can you know, during moments of difficulties we'll consult with them. And we actually were using another company initially and had a not nearly as good of an experience, and specifically with duties we had a real clusterfuck, if I'm allowed to say that, where they advised us, it, because our product is very unique, it's not clear what HTS code it fell under. And there were two that kind of seemed like potential fits, one with a much higher duty than the other. And they advised us to submit to the government for a sort of a ruling on which one, and they failed to submit the paperwork properly. Basically, it came down to, and this is probably very unique to us, but it came down to like the amount of acidity in the product, and they reported the amount of vinegar instead of the sort of acidity of the vinegar. And because of that, it appeared that we had breached this threshold of acidity that was sort of the deciding point between these two codes. And so we, by submitting that, we sort of locked ourselves into the wrong code, and it took like 2 years to get paid back, because we then resubmitted with the correct information and eventually got it approved. And the whole process from sort of resubmitting to getting the checks back for the difference was a 2-year process. Thankfully it actually happened, but painful. And so now, you know, our duties are just fixed on weight. For a long time, our shipping rates were very stable, and COVID, like in so many other areas, was definitely threw that into a storm. And you know, since the beginning of the year, really, we've just been getting hit by continual shipping freight increases. I think, you know, every shipping line has its own unique challenges, and they're all kind of interrelated, and the sort of the disruptions from COVID are said to take like 2 years to kind of work themselves all the way through. But in our case, basically, there were nine ships a week from Italy before COVID. And then when all the factories shut down, they cut it to six. And then production rebounded even more than before. And they never increased it back to nine. So now you have like even more demand than you had before with, you know, 30%+ fewer ships. And so we're getting hit really hard, and there's really nothing we can do. Thankfully, our products, the beans more than the dips, but are not terribly heavy. So we can stack all the way up to the top of the container. And it's a premium item. You know, people selling low price commodities are getting hit a lot harder. But it's significant. It's been a significant challenge, and I was shitting my pants during the Suez Canal crisis. Like that was right in the middle of all these other problems. And I was scared during COVID too. There were moments where like there weren't even containers available, which was scary. But thankfully we avoided really like showstopper type situations. But I wouldn't have wanted to have the wrong freight broker in place during these times.
So it's, you know, it's interesting if we just kind of look at that, right? Like you have number one, when you're, you know, clearly folks that are just, or brands that are just focused domestically, you know, have their own challenges, right? But when you're international, like what you're saying, where you're, you know, have your manufacturing relationships, you have to deal with foreign currency exchange, which is completely out of your hand. You have to deal with freight, you know, have strategic partnerships with freight forwarders, making sure that they're the right one, but, you know, duties and taxes or freight, you know, fees getting increased or having shortages is out of your hand. You have geo or international political situations like the Suez Canal or COVID and things like that, that can impact you as well. So it's a lot of uncertainty. If you look at like your, you know, overall kind of landed cost structure of the cost, you know, to the customer contribution margin standpoint, you have your product that has fluctuation on foreign currency. You have freight that has possible fluctuation in fees. You have dues and taxes that can be increased. You have all these structures that.
And then you have the
to just pure, just normal, just business, right? So you have to kind of structure and really, you know, be strategic about those items, because any of those items, to your point, could literally put you out of business.
Yes, and we have the new FDA FSVP program that we need to be compliant on. The requirements are low when you're a very small company, but it's not a very high sales threshold, and so there's a lot of additional compliance work versus sourcing domestically. So there's that as well. One change we've made that was very painful to execute on, but now puts us in a much better position, that we did recently, is we used to do everything in Italy, including the sort of kitting for e-commerce.
Yep.
And that was not a great setup, because, you know, it increased lead times. The manufacturer wasn't really set up for kitting. It's already hard to project far enough out when you have a transatlantic lead time, but But then, you know, adding more lead time and projecting the exact kit makeup so far ahead of time is incredibly difficult. And so now we just import only the items in bulk, and we do all of the kitting in the U.S., which helps us with lead times. It helps us with inventory management. It improved our unit freight costs, and you know, we're happily working with a 3PL in the US that is you know, set up for this kind of stuff in a way that Italy wasn't.
Good. Well, you know, it sounds like, you know, one, you know, feedback item for the audience here is just consistently reviewing your, you know, clearly your supply chain, where you can find some savings in terms of, you know, cash savings, specifically the bottom line. But a huge aspect of this is pure, you know, opportunity costs with your cash and inventory, right? And so if you can shrink that lead time down and minimize that cash cycle from cash going out to buy product to cash coming in from customers, and that's a huge win, because then you have that cash to, that you can do other things with, right? Or buy other products, or buy other raw materials, or invest in other items. So that's a huge aspect of that. A few more questions. Number one, when COVID hit last year, Italy was the first kind of country where, you know, in that area in Europe, was the first one that kind of, you know, shut down. So like, clearly you're from, you know, your products from Italy. So how did you respond to that in relation to, like, you know, having your inventory, unsure of, you know, when you're going to get more inventory, but also then the inventory I have, what channels can I focus on or sell in? And how did you kind of decide that and maybe switch some, you know, short-term tactical strategies within that?
Yeah, I mean, it would have been incredibly helpful had we already made the transition to shipping bulk and kitting here, because that would have allowed us to be much more versatile. But that was a crazy time. I mean, Italy was, you know, the first country after China to get hit. I was actually there, like, launching the dips in February, right as it was starting. There, people were wearing masks on the plane. I saw people, you know, wearing masks in unusual ways in the airport, and it was, you know, very few people knew about it, yet there was just already this kind of vibe. I think there was, like, maybe the first story of an infection in Italy, but there was no outbreak yet. And then obviously, you know, I'm in touch with Italy all the time, and so I saw this kind of slow moving freight train crash happening in Italy. And so the bad news was that we were sort of at the European epicenter. The good news was that I was way ahead of the curve because of that. Like, I saw the same sort of progression that was happening in Italy, I saw happening in the US. And so we scrambled to get as much product as we could out as possible. Obviously, you know, that's not every company can do that, depending on your capital position and your shelf life. But you know, that was our main strategy. Our fear was that if it got worse, or if there was a contagion in the factory, we would get shut down. And so we tried to get everything out we could. And then there were reports of there was a strike at a port in Italy, workers demanding, you know, better safety or whatever. And so I was nervous ports are going to get shut down. And then the crazy thing is, while these containers were on the ocean, New York, New Jersey became the next epicenter. So I was literally importing from one epicenter to the other epicenter. Gotcha. And so it was crazy times. I went into, you know, I basically reallocated my capital from sales growth to inventory. And I went into batten down the hatches mode on the cost side, and, you know, cut everything that was sort of growth oriented and you know, future oriented I could, and then reallocated that capital to bringing in as much as I could. And then, you know, it turned out that we never had any major problems with our supply chain. Our factory was incredibly diligent, like the highest safety standards. They never had any issues. It was really amazing. They had to operate in this terrible environment of like not being able to eat together, see each other, speak to each other. People were, you know, kids were living with them at home. Like they're the father or the husband, you know, the husband or the wife had to stay home with the kids. It was like really crazy, difficult time, but they never stopped and never shut down and never had any issues. And so that was amazing. And, you know, our worst fears thankfully didn't come true, but it was, you know, it was the right way to approach it.
Gotcha. I mean, that's just a fascinating story and really kind of, you know, the short-term tactical decisions around cash management, right? And slowing down kind of, you know, acquisition of new customers and advertising and marketing to kind of more maintenance of existing customers. Let's make sure everybody's happy across all channels to kind of keep it going and maintain it for as long as we can until we get, you know, new information or until things change. And it's interesting. And clearly as a small business owner, that's very key, is just kind of having access to data, you know, whether that's what is my cash position? What is my, you know, margins? What inventory do I have in hand? How much can I sell? Which channels, you know, how do I reallocate them amongst warehouses? It's very important to have that kind of real-time information at your fingertips if and when something like this happens.
Yeah. And we did pay the price on the inventory. We, you know, it was next to impossible to project when we were ordering up like that, how our demand would cut across SKUs and items. And so we did end up paying a price there. And, you know, since things didn't shut down, we would have been better off just kind of managing it as we went. But, you know, with the information we had, it was the right move.
Yeah, sometimes you got to make those tough decisions just to say, hey, you know, if this happens, at least we'll still be in business or give our best position to be in business in 3 months versus like taking that kind of, you know, that more risk-based approach. And clearly that's what you do with like the foreign exchange management and things like that, is like, hey, I may not get the biggest upside, but at a minimum, I'm minimizing risk as much as possible. And I'm trying to take out.
Yeah, exactly.
You're taking out.
Yeah. We took the approach like better to keep our current customers happy than try to, you know, and save where we can on gaining new customers, then, you know, try to get too smart on inventory management and at the expense of, potentially our existing relationships.
Yeah. It's much easier to keep existing customers happy and, you know, and cheaper than it is to acquire new customers in that aspect. So awesome. Well, this has been a fantastic, you know, informative, you know, interview. We haven't had one of these in relation to specifically talking about foreign exchange and importing and the challenges you have. So I think it'll be very informative to the audience, you know, as we finish up on all of the month end podcast here, you know, targeted toward, you know, the emerging CPG brand founders and key players in the industry. Like, can you just, you know, as we kind of wrap up, what is one do or one recommendation that you'd, you know, tell the audience here?
Yeah. I mean, I think it follows along from what we were just talking about, which is to really be on top of your forecasting and supply planning. You know, it's not an easy thing, especially if you're omni-channel and, you know, and distributors have, you know, peaks and troughs in their demand. It's not an easy thing at all, but, you really want to, you know, get really buttoned up on your forecasting and lead time and supply planning so that you sort of manage the right sort of weeks on hand for especially for your key products and your key customers. And you don't want to invest so much in getting accounts opened and velocity moving, and there's so much that goes into getting channels set up to then, you know, find after making that investment, find that you don't have the supply is you know, really shooting yourself in the foot. And of course, on the other hand, you have to, you know, manage your capital and your inventory out of stocks. And so, you know, getting the right weeks on hand number and having a really solid forecasting foundation to managing that is essential.
Definitely. Inventory management, precision of inventory in hand, day-to-day real-time information. You know, we definitely agree with that aspect. You know, clearly your biggest spend, your biggest outflow of money as a CPG brand is inventory. So the key is, you know, inventory efficiency, capital efficiency, you know, manage that as closely as you can, minimizing that cash cycle from when you spend money versus when you receive money, keeping existing customers happy. All right, and then what is one don't or one not to do for the folks out there?
Yeah, I mean, this one is more just something that I tell a lot of first time early entrepreneurs in the space when they ask me that I think, you know, seems obvious but can be overlooked. I've noticed by these entrepreneurs, which is the importance of having healthy margins. I've seen entrepreneurs sort of discount the needed margin to be successful in this business. And so unless you have, you know, a lot of capital and a very sure way of raising your margins as you grow, you need to have very healthy margins. Like there's a lot of deductions, a lot of marketing spend. It's a capital intensive business. You want to have very healthy margins and be very precise in your calculation of them. And then kind of relatedly, you want to know your contribution margin in any channel you're in or want to be in, and think through what the capital implications are of launching a new channel.
Definitely. And, you know, just from an aspect of margins, I think, you know, your margin is your probably most important number to really focus on. Everybody focuses on top line revenue, but if you have a ton of money and ton of capital behind you, you can grow that top line literally as high as you want it, as long as you're spending on advertising, right? But you're literally cost acquire customers, you know, super high, your lifetime value of a customer may be like really low, but top line's growing, but your margins suck. Then at the end of the day, like nobody really cares from an investment standpoint or kind of a long-term strategic play for your business. So understanding margins and really analyzing that. And if it's low, then understand how can you raise 10 points on that margin over the next 3 or 4 years, whether it's, you know, savings on freight or savings on raw materials, or over time, I'm going to tweak this or tweak that. It's all about having a plan, but understanding those margins and having a game plan, you know, moving forward and how you can improve them if there's a possibility there. excuse me. Well, Aaron, thanks for the time and information today. This was a great chat. And I think, again, the audience here, I think is going to get a lot of information around some of the points we chatted on. Before we leave, Brahmi, people can buy Brahmi, what, www.brahmisnacks.com. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the best place. And if you subscribe on our website, you get the best pricing on the internet. And we're also available on Thrive, which is a Thrive Market. It's a membership, natural foods membership supplier, and there you get special member rates. And then we're available on Amazon, and we are, as of July, as of this month, we are in the bean section of Whole Foods across the country. Should be every door.
Awesome. Yeah. And just so everybody knows, they sell the bean packets like Aaron chatted about, but they also have hummus. So very and cool.
Not to mention all the other regional accounts that we love across the country. Hard to name them all here, but We have a lot of great regional retailers that we love to work with who also carry them. You can find the beans either on either in the healthy snack set or in the shelf stable veggie bean area. The dips are only available online, Amazon, Thrive, and on our website, where again I recommend subscribing to save.
Awesome. Yeah, we may have a little bump up in the Google search for Lupini beans after this chat, Aaron. So again, Aaron Gotti from Brahmi, really enjoyed the chat, Aaron. Thanks for the time. Have a good one.
Same to you.